It's time for Live and Local. It's your connection to local music and more. I'm Kevin Kelly. Different sort of program today. There is a symposium at the University of Illinois for a couple of days, which actually starts in about an hour and a half at the Levis Faculty Center in Urbana. It's called Shostakovich, the Quartets in Context. And it features some of the leading scholars at the University of Illinois and across the country on Shostakovich and things Russian. It comes out of the Department of Slavic Languages and Literatures, with a lot of other sponsors as well. And there are three keynote speakers during the conference. We're pleased to have two of them on the show today. Simon Morrison, who will be giving his in about an hour and 45 minutes at 1:45. And then Richard Taruskin, who will give the keynote address before the final installment of the Pacifica Quartet's traversal of the complete cycle of 15-string quartets by Shostakovich. That's going to be tomorrow night, happening at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. So we should have a lively conversation, lots of musical samples, and maybe even a little controversy on the show today. It's Live and Local on FM 90.9. And those were a few excerpts from Dmitri Shostakovich's incidental music to a performance of Shakespeare's play Hamlet, starting with Ophelia's song and then a lullaby, the Requiem, and a movement called The Tournament with the Boston Pops Orchestra here, conducted by Arthur Fiedler. And that was sort of a sampling of some of the variety you and some of the extremes you get in Shostakovich's music, which we're going to be talking about for this hour here on Live and Local. I'm Kevin Kelly. The Department of Slavic Languages and Literatures at the University of Illinois, along with various other sponsors, co-sponsors, is presenting a symposium on Shostakovich starting at 1:30 today at the Levis Faculty Center. And there are lots of different presenters on a wide variety of topics, although the symposium is called The Quartets in Context, leading up to the final installment by the Pacifica Quartet, which is the quartet in residence at the University of Illinois, of all of Shostakovich's string quartets. That's going to be Tuesday night at the Krannert Center with quartets 11, 13, 14, and 15, and there were 15 in total. And so that's sort of the culminating event in this symposium. But among the many speakers are two of the three keynote speakers who are with us on the show today, Richard Taruskin and Simon Morrison, Professor Taruskin at the University of California at Berkeley, and Professor Morrison at Princeton University. And they were vying with each other before we actually opened the microphones to see who was least qualified to be here. So I don't think I'm even going to run down the credentials, because they were talking about all the reasons that they could be really talking about something else. But you both teach a wide variety of subjects, not only in and around Shostakovich, Russian music and literature, and lots of other things, music appreciation included. But you have managed to get yourself to this symposium for some legitimate reason, I'm sure. Professor Taruskin, how did you come to Shostakovich's music?
Yes, well, my legitimacy is not for me to judge. but my reason for being here, I think, has to do with the fact that I took a rather prominent role in very contentious debates about Shostakovich's legacy, in which I supported the position of a woman named Laurel Fay, who was the third keynoter, the one with the strongest credentials where Shostakovich is concerned, who is the author of the best biography of Shostakovich in any language. And fortunately for us, that language is English. And she was the one who took the lead in debunking a very famous book that was published in the late 1970s, a book called Testimony, that purported to be the memoirs of Shostakovich as dictated to a Russian music journalist named Solomon Volkov. It was a book that portrayed Shostakovich very differently from the way we had regarded him previously in the West, as having been a product, a authentic product of Soviet culture. This book of purported memoirs showed Shostakovich to be something very nearly a dissident. And then it became, for a while, quite fashionable to interpret Shostakovich's music in light of this evident dissidence. Laurel Fay showed that the book had been put together out of a multiplicity of sources, only part of which were actual memoirs as dictated to Volkov, and cast very, very strong doubts on the reliability of the book. But those who supported the new position on Shostakovich objected very strongly to her intervention. And so I, as a fellow scholar with Laurel Fay and as somebody who had access to rather more public media than most musicologists have, since I had been writing for the New York Times for some time, I wrote some articles in which I defended her position, and that attracted a lot of attention to the debate, and it associated me with the debate. Although, as I was saying to you before we went on the air, I have not myself contributed any fundamental research towards the spreading of knowledge about Shostakovich, but my long association with Laurel and with the debate has made me one of the figures that people do think of in connection with Shostakovich today.
And Professor Morrison, how did you come to Shostakovich, and how does he figure in your own work?
I actually haven't written a lot about Shostakovich. I did a long essay about his early ballet, The Bolt, and an essay review. And I was invited here, I think, because to some degree I represent the, not the antipode, but a composer who was parallel to Shostakovich in a lot of ways, but who was a more international figure and who did not get along with Shostakovich. And to some degree, I think, took advantage of the ups and downs of Shostakovich's career in his own way, at least for a few years. And that composer was Prokofiev. And owing to the fact that I've done some poking around in the Shostakovich archive and seen what some of the problems are in terms of access, Professor Fink here in the Slavic department approached me and sort of asked me to be part of this. And I think I was challenged by him to some degree to see whether or not I could actually find something new about this composer to talk about, or at least to look at his present-day reception and the issues that are now associated with him in the post-Soviet environment, especially now that there is a new collected edition of his works underfoot. So my presence at this event is modestly associated with the papers, the documents, what the composer worked on and what he was like as a craftsman.
And your keynote, which is going to be the first of the three that has been mentioned, Laurel Fay is going to be second, and then as I mentioned in the introduction to the show, Professor Truskin's is going to be really the introduction to the quartet's performance tomorrow
night. Yes, Simon and I are the alpha and the omega. He's the first speaker, and the symposium I'm going to be the last speaker.
And yours, Simon, is called Ghosts.
Right.
What does that reference?
I was interested. I actually took the title. There was a short essay that was written by Peter Rabinowitz on the 8-string quartet, and it was about the idea that there are references within that work that are sort of semi-references. There are ghost presences, quotations that may or may not be there, allusions to other works that may or may not be there. And I took that title because what I was interested in is sort of ending with a discussion, a brief discussion of that work, but actually looking at the sources of some of the string quartets and sketches, manuscripts of those works, which to some degree the Shostakovich archive has, for various interesting commercial reasons, suppressed. And I wanted to talk about them and actually view these archival documents as the sort of ghosts of completed works. So I'm just using that as a broad metaphor. And also, I think that more than any other composer in the 20th century, Shostakovich's legacy is interestingly, which is, I think, the best way to put it, interestingly haunted by the 20th century past. One thing that amazes me about Shostakovich is he lived until 1975. But I think he's forever associated not only with Soviet politics, but with Stalinism. He lived, you know, more than 20 years after Stalin died, but he's forever associated, at least in the Western imagination, with the Stalinist period. So that haunts his works, if not, and I don't think it haunted him necessarily, as much as it seems to haunt his reception.
Well, and associated one way or another with Stalinism, and that's part of the debate, isn't it? You know,
Shostakovich was fated to live in terms of that Chinese curse. You know, he was fated to live in interesting times. And it's very difficult now to hear his work as anything except an embodiment of the times in which he lived. That's the source of most of the controversy about Shostakovich. To what extent is Shostakovich's work a kind of coded diary or a kind of coded chronicle of events that were taking place around Shostakovich? To what extent are we well advised, or to what extent are we in fact obliged to interpret his music in that way? And Shostakovich's music is so full of references, external references, as Simon was saying, particularly his Eighth Quartet, which is the work, inevitably, that Simon will be mentioning in his talk. That work now is taken as a kind of Rosetta Stone, offering a key to the interpretation of Shostakovich's works as a whole. There are some of us who resist that attempt to turn that work into a kind of key to the whole of Shostakovich's oeuvre, the reason being that any such definite interpretation is a limitation on the way in which we're able to respond to the work.
Well, and actually the few short samples that I just played from Hamlet sort of gives, you know, I played the one movement and you said, oh, that comes from...
I actually mistook it for the 10th symphony for a while because of the similar elevated, lamenting sound, which we do associate.
Powerful and dark.
Very powerful, especially with Shostakovich's later work in his post-Stalinist period. The reason why, as Simon was saying, we still tend to associate Shostakovich with the Stalinist period is because he was so obviously buffeted by the political events of those days, and some of his most famous works were responses to things that actually happened in his life. For example, his Fifth Symphony, which was the work that immediately followed the denunciation of his opera, The Lady Macbeth of the Mtsensk District. For a while, Shostakovich was in ill repute. He rehabilitated his reputation with this very, very strong symphony that people read as patriotic. And it came out in a very fraught year, 1937, which was the very height of the Stalinist terror. And then, of course, the next work of his that became world famous was his Seventh Symphony, which was written to a certain extent in response to the German advance and finally the siege on Leningrad, which was Shostakovich's city. Well, these are works that have very definite relations and correlations with the events not only of his life, but the life of all of his countrymen, and of course, when we're talking about World War II, with all of our lives, or all of our lives as then led by perhaps our parents and our grandparents, these are very, very fraught contexts. And of course, that invests these works with a tremendously compelling interest, which of course rubs off on the rest of his work. The question then becomes, are the rest of his works also commentaries in the way that these pieces obviously are?
Well, then there's an awful lot of music where it's just sheer entertainment. He wrote it for films. He wrote it for ballets. He wrote it just for fun. And that's, I mean, that can be, I think a lot of the, well, I actually remember the first piece Shostakovich that I heard, which I believe was the 10th Symphony of all things when I was a kid.
That isn't sheer entertainment.
No, it was not sheer entertainment. And I wondered, who is this guy? And even the record jacket was imposing in one way or another. And
I know what record it was. Was it Metropolis's recording?
I think it was Rodzinski.
Rodzinski. Metropolis's recording, which I believe was the first American recording of the 10th Symphony, had a war orphan on the cover, looking very, very bedraggled and very, very, you know, pitiable. Of course, that colors your reception of the music. And I think even Shostakovich's entertaining music is read through a very complicated prism now. Mm. Nothing with Shostakovich is free of complication. Well, that's why we have symposiums about him.
Sure. We'll get into some of the specifics of the controversy in a little bit. But let's hear the very beginning of this Eighth Quartet that we've referenced a number of times, which the Pacifica Quartet did in its second installment of these four recitals they will have given as of Tuesday night of all the 15 quartets, and it's just an astounding piece of music, even just on its own. I mean, you wouldn't need to know anything about Shostakovich to know that there's something powerful going on here. And it really can be quite devastating, including from the very beginning. One of the things that he quotes with regularity, not only in this piece but in a lot of other pieces, is his own name in a way. Bach had a motto where, you know, his own name was spelled out, and so did Shostakovich, which is D-S-C-H, the D meaning the note D. S is the German designation for E-flat, not worth understanding going into why, and then C and then B natural. And you hear this almost right away in this. Let's just hear at least some of this opening movement from the Eighth Quartet. This is a performance by the Borodin String Quartet on Live and Local, and we're talking with Richard Taruskin and Simon Morrison, two of the three keynote speakers for the symposium today and tomorrow at the University of Illinois called Shostakovich, the Quartets in Context. And that would have led, had I not put it on programs, directly into the second movement of the Eighth String Quartet of Dmitri Shostakovich. And it actually, I probably should have let it run in there because it gets extremely energetic and not to say even threatening sounding music in this sort of most biographical, perhaps, of most obviously biographical of Shostakovich's own pieces, in that he quotes himself right and left and names himself again and again. It's the Borodin String Quartet performing on Live and Local. You can hear the Pacifica Quartet, which is in residence at the University of Illinois, play the last 3 + 1 of the 15 quartets of Shostakovich tomorrow night at 7:30 at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. It will be introduced by the third of the keynote speakers for a symposium that is now going on at the University of Illinois called Shostakovich, the Quartets in Context. That speaker is Professor Richard Taruskin of University of California at Berkeley. And the first of the keynotes, there are three, will be given by Professor Simon Morrison of Princeton University at 1:45 today. And it's all happening, well, the symposium is happening at the Levis Faculty Center on the University of Illinois campus in Urbana. So where does the controversy, Professor Taruskin, you said that in a way the controversy starts, at least as far as Laurel Fay is concerned and your own entrance into this world, but also in the changing of how people have viewed Shostakovich's life and music with this so-called memoir called Testimony. Mm. And I remember when I was preparing for, actually specifically for the quartet piece in a performance that I conducted, the chamber version some years ago, finding it difficult to find any sense of authority from the various references I could find, because everybody was seemed to be arguing with everybody over whether Volkov was a fake, who was right, was Shostakovich a Stalinist really, was he a protester really, I mean, what was he? So what was there about this testimony that sparked the controversy?
Well, what he was really, we will never know, obviously. And I'm sure that he didn't know. Do we know who we are really? But what we can tell is when somebody has falsified evidence. This is what Laurel Fay proved in the case of Volkov. For me to give you a resume of the whole process of proof would be a long story, an interesting story. I wouldn't mind doing it, except it would keep us from the music for a long time. But the real controversy about interpreting Shostakovich has to do with pieces like the one from which you just played an excerpt, a piece that begins with Shostakovich's musical monogram, the D-S-C-H, and proceeds to quote half a dozen of his own earlier works, including some works that have very fraught contexts, like the last scene of his opera, The Lady Macbeth of the Mtsensky's, which portrays convicts en route to Siberia, a practice that did not end in the Tsarist period, but was continuing during Shostakovich's own time. So you put his musical monogram together with the scene of convict labor, of course, there is a suggestion of what exactly, I couldn't tell you, but he is obviously signaling to us that this is music that demands interpretation. How do we interpret? In light of what do we interpret? That, as you say, is the question. Since the time of the Volkov controversy, a great deal of primary documentation has been published about Shostakovich, so we have a firmer footing now. We know, for example, something we didn't know before the early 1990s, which is that Shostakovich wrote his Eighth Quartet, the one in which he puts his own monogram in the context of a lot of very elegiac reminiscences through quotes of his own music. He wrote that quartet in the aftermath of his being pressured to join the Soviet Communist Party. He wrote about this at length in a letter to a friend of his named Isaac Glickman, who published his correspondence with Shostakovich in 1993, I believe. And so knowing that context does show that Shostakovich had a reason to be looking back in a melancholy way on his life. He was sorry about joining the Communist Party because he'd never wanted to be involved with political organizations, they being extremely distracting and time-consuming. But he found it very difficult to withstand pressure. And so he felt disappointment with himself, as he put it in his letter to Glickman. And so that motivated his melancholy reflections as put into this quartet, but in a very explicit way, in a way that forces us to interpret the music autobiographically. And then once we form the habit, it's a very hard habit to shed.
Well, isn't that in itself one of the questions about how to interpret Shostakovich, either his music or just his life, which is that, okay, so he joined the Communist Party. He did so reluctantly, according to this letter, but there's some question, was he really a hero or was he really a coward, you know, in dealing with the authorities? Because Prokofiev left. I mean, you referenced Simon Morrison, you referenced earlier that, you know, Prokofiev was more a man of the world. Shostakovich never went anywhere, and some people would say, well, that's because he just sort of stayed in the Soviet system and was therefore guilty.
Well, he went on a couple of trips abroad. He received an honorary doctorate in England. He went to the United States. He didn't seem to have had a particularly good time on those trips.
Well, he was sent on those, though, wasn't he?
In fact, the Eighth Quartet was written in Germany.
Was it?
He was in Germany to work on a war documentary, write some music for it. But this is what he wrote instead.
And he got an honorary doctorate, actually, at my alma mater, was Northwestern.
Northwestern.
Was, I think, the other place that he went. Yeah, that's the other place he went.
I don't know if he appeared at that one, but
he was there.
Yeah.
Pictures are in my alumni magazine. They brag. You know,
I will do so.
Universities brag about things like that. You know.
Yeah, the eight string quartet was, as Richard mentioned, was composed while sort of literally overlooking the ruins of Dresden, and it was composed very quickly, 3 days, flat, and it was composed for a film which was a joint Soviet East German production called 5 Days and 5 Nights. And then at some point, and for reasons that are unclear. He didn't sort of talk about it in his letters. He didn't really talk very much about his process except in sardonic ways. He converted it into a string quartet. And one of the interesting things about then, if you actually think about this work, is some sort of autobiographical statement or the moves that go from it being conceived for a film, which would presumably be not about Shostakovich, which is a life story, into something that is about his life story. And where did he begin the work? The most poignant work, movement, is the fifth movement, which is a fugue based exclusively or almost exclusively on the letters of his name. Did he compose that movement first and then decide that he should backtrack and actually create this sort of autobiographical summation or not? And if it's a summation of his career or a commentary on his life, it's an odd one because although there are numerous references to very important works in his career, there are some strange references as well. And in fact, now there's a lot of activity, people who do music analysis to actually sleuth through this score, and you get a sense after a while that maybe everything within the work is a quote of some sort or another, real or imagined. So it's hard to figure out what game he's playing with the listener.
There was always questions. He never answers. And you ask, was he a hero? Was he a coward? Well, I think most either-or questions can be resolved by invoking both and. Yeah, he was a hero and he was a coward. He was a hero in that he was able to give voice to what people were feeling in a way that could not be done directly, had to be done obliquely through such devices as musical symbolism. And yet, when he was confronted with political pressure, he usually gave in to it. So he always reproached himself for his political cowardice, although it is also possible to look back on him as a kind of political hero. So these kinds of contradictions, I think, coexist in the lives of most people. And in the case of great artists, well, the contradictions become public property, and they fuel public debate.
Well, we're going to hear a little bit of one of the most, well, probably the most incendiary piece that he wrote as far as his own career was concerned, that he'd really put himself in jeopardy. But first, let me mention again that we're talking with Richard Truscan and Simon Morrison, who are keynote speakers at the symposium happening today and tomorrow at the University of Illinois called Shostakovich, the Quartets in Context at the Levis Faculty Center, and you're welcome to attend. You're listening to Live and Local on FM 90.9. Programs today are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, featuring an evening of Mozart, Chopin, and Beethoven with the Opole Philharmonic of Poland on Thursday, February 24th at 7:30 p.m. More information about upcoming events is at krannertcenter.com.
Thank you for responding to our call to share your comments about federal funding with your congressional representative. Because the future of WILL and public broadcasting is at stake, it is important that your elected representatives hear directly from you about whether or not funding for public broadcasting should be continued. An easy way to stay informed is to sign up at 170millionamericans.org. That's 170millionamericans.org. Thank you.
This station playing this piece is not a good idea.
We were just sort of laughing a bit over that. I mean, not that there's anything funny. By the way, well, you can get an update on that by going to that 170 million Americans website. I was going to go into that. I won't go into that. But things have already happened and are definitely happening and moving quickly. So if you would like to explore that, that would be a good idea to do it sooner than later. The piece we're going to sample next that, you know, may be somewhat risky, but it was much more risky in Shostakovich's day at the time that he wrote it and presented it, which is his opera, which is now called Lady Macbeth of Mtsensk, or of the Mtsensk district. And why don't one of you just say briefly, what was the controversy? Because we're going to play maybe the most shocking part of the opera.
Why don't we play the part that was controversial and let your listeners guess?
That we'll would
tell
be
them
fine.
Afterwards.
Let's see if they figure out what is going on.
Yeah, this won't be a hard one, I think.
Even though it's in Russian. So let's just say there's...
Certain things are international.
Yeah, there's a woman and there's a man, and we'll leave it at that.
And there's a trombone.
So the question we were, I guess, asking to guess is what just happened in
yes.
that opera? It isn't described except by music. And even if you understood Russian, you wouldn't necessarily know just from the words what is going on here.
Well, this is the love scene, would you believe?
love meaning...
well, yes, very
a little rough.
A very violent love scene, a scene that obviously is more a rape than a love. Than in a conventional love scene. And it was that very stark naturalistic music that led to this opera's being denounced in an unsigned editorial in Pravda on January 28th, 1936. It's a date that Shostakovich never forgot and one that Shostakovich students like us never forget. It introduced a period of rather draconian arts policy in the USSR. So Shostakovich was living under a cloud for a year or more after that piece came out. It led to the cancellation of the premiere of his Fourth Symphony, which had been scheduled for later in 1936, but was not actually performed until 1961. So that was a tremendous blow to Shostakovich.
But that unsigned editorial was reported to have been written by Stalin.
Well, yes, when people
have been put up to
it. Unsigned pieces can be speculatively attributed to anybody. I don't think Stalin had the time to write music reviews. But no doubt it was written at his request or at his, he had an interest in having it written.
Because he was at the opera.
He had attended a performance, and Shostakovich was notified that he would be there and that he should be prepared to be summoned to Stalin's box, as another composer, Ivan Dzerzhinsky, had been summoned to be praised for an opera called Quiet Flows the Don, earlier in the same festival that was going on in Moscow. Shostakovich came, was waiting for the summons, never came. And later he found out that Stalin had left before the final act. And then a few days later, this review appeared, which led ultimately to the cancellation of the performances of this opera for the next, 25 years. The opera, too, was under a ban. And it was only with the performance of the Fifth Symphony in November of 1937 that Shostakovich became once again one of the foremost composers whose music was approved.
That was, I don't know if, I think it was out in testimony where Shostakovich is quoted as saying that it's after some point, and it may have been at this point, where he started to live with a suitcase by his door, you know, because he never knew when the knock was going to come to take him away and presumably have him either deported or killed. True, or literally true or not, I mean,
We never can tell what is true in retrospect unless there's some form of documentation. The only documentation here is a story that was not actually in testimony, but it was in a book of memoirs of Shostakovich by people who knew him, which was assembled by a woman named Elizabeth Wilson, a cellist and a writer on music who spent a lot of time in the USSR because her father was the British ambassador to the Soviet Union. And she studied cello. She studied cello with Rostropovich and observed Soviet music up close. And she wrote a marvelous book in which she assembled memoirs of Shostakovich, including a memoir by a composer friend of Shostakovich's named Vossner. Or was it Vossner, Simon?
Vossner,
Benjamin. Yes, Benjamin Vossner, who recalled that Shostakovich was summoned to the headquarters of the NKVD, as it was called then, now the KGB, not now, but in the later Soviet period, the KGB, for questioning, and he assumed he was going to be arrested and was only spared arrest because his interrogator was arrested, which was a common story in those days, which is a reason to doubt the actual veracity of the story because it was told about so many people.
Well, and going back to the hero or coward question, I mean, if you're living and working in a medium like music, where people are going to hear it, and it can be so easily interpreted in an era, in the Stalinist era, you know, where you actually have this guy at your concert, and he leaves, and you probably are going to quake in your boots because, you know, that could be it for you, you know, and to have persevered almost automatically makes you a hero, or at least makes it very easy for anybody in a later time to say, oh, well, he didn't live up, you know, he was no hero because he, you know, caved in or whatever, but he still survived and he still wrote music.
I think one of the problems I have with the hero narrative is, besides the basic fact of we don't know what it was like to have lived in 36 and 37 in that period in that place, which was horrible from all accounts, is a lot of people had tragic ends and a lot of people were arrested and interrogated and sent away. Shostakovich, it must have been horrible to live during that period. It was horrible for everybody. And I think that if we view him as a martyr because of the denunciation of this very famous opera, which was an international success and was being performed in multiple theaters at the time of its denunciation, we overlook the fact that obviously around this period, there were a lot of people who were you know, of less elite stature, mm-hmm. who were being unceremoniously just disappeared, no questions asked. And that's, I think, an ethical consideration for us in writing about this case. This was a regime that very much valued celebrity artists, and Shostakovich had a good existence from a material standpoint. He suffered as an artist owing to the fact that, you know, there was these outside constraints imposed on him. Like other artists, he didn't necessarily know the rules. But one of the things I asked my students or talked to my students about is how many elite composers were arrested? How many died? And I can think of, you know, a couple that were arrested, Theremin later on or Moscheles briefly. But, you know, the big examples of senior artists or major artists who disappeared were Meyerhold, Babel, and a few others. Elite artists were, you know, to some degree spared the worst of it. And Shostakovich had, if nothing else, if he was a product of this system or certainly a product of this context, he at least had some sense of how to maneuver and some sense of at least who was making the decisions against him. And probably some sense who actually was behind that editorial.
Weren't writers of literature more likely to get it than writers of music?
Messing with the word was the worst thing to do. That's why words were trouble.
Words give you less deniability than music. You can always argue that music is simply music.
Or that's not what I meant.
Or that's not what I meant. Right. Well, of course, writers of words can also say that's not what I meant. But it's much harder to defend yourself against such allegations. One of the reasons why musicians were suffered less under Stalinist repression than writers did.
You wouldn't know this from most of the music we've played so far, except a little bit at the very beginning, that I read quite a bit that Shostakovich was supposed to have had quite a sense of humor. I mean, actually, in person. Mm-hmm. You know, the pictures we see of him are all somber and unsmiling.
Yes, a great sense of humor if he knew you and trusted you.
Is that how it went?
If he didn't know you, he was extremely shy. Mm. This I know from certain, people who I know who didn't know him but met him.
Yeah.
Very uncommunicative to strangers. Well, of course, that's something you learn to be.
Let's hear another sample of his music, and this is the one, as you referenced earlier, Professor Tereskin, about you know, sort of brought his reputation back, saved his butt, so to speak. And we're going to hear the sort of heroic end to this fabulous piece of music, arguably his most famous, I guess, depends the context. His Symphony No. 5, also out of 15. Were there 15 symphonies? 15 symphonies, 15 string quartets. Mm-hmm. And this comes at the very end of the fourth of the four movements, here conducted by the guy who premiered many of his symphonies.
Including this one.
Mm-hmm. Yevgeny Mravinsky. From late in his life, 1992, this was made, with the Leningrad Philharmonic, now known as the St. Petersburg Philharmonic, and here on Live and Local. End of the Fifth Symphony of Dmitri Shostakovich with the Leningrad Philharmonic Orchestra conducted by Yevgeny Mravinsky here on Live and Local on FM 90.9. And we're talking about Shostakovich in the context of a symposium which opens in about 40 minutes at the University of Illinois. One of our guests here, Simon Morrison, is slated to give the first keynote address in less than 45 minutes. So we have him for another eight, and he is here with Richard Tereskin, who is giving the third of the three keynote addresses, and then the second one being given by Laurel Fay. Laurel Fay's will be this evening at 8 o'clock, and then Richard Tereskin's tomorrow evening at 6:15, which will precede the concert by the Pacifica Quartet at the Krannert Center. And they are playing string quartets 11, 13, 14, and 15. And that's the fourth concert of their complete traversal of those quartets. And they've really been fabulous. I've seen two of them so far, and they'll be there tomorrow night as well. I really want to say thanks again to both of you for for taking the time to do this in the midst of, and I'm glad you were able to come in a little earlier than some of the other folks, which is partly how we got you. Professor Truskin, we asked Simon Morrison about his theme, Ghosts. Yours has a little more generic title for your talk, which is Some Post-Centennial Reflections.
Yeah, that's my little in-joke, because in 2006, which was Shostakovich's centennial year, I spent the whole year declining invitations to address centennial symposia. I was kind of sick and tired of the kind of debates one would get drawn into about Shostakovich in those days. I'm wondering whether the atmosphere has cleared a little bit. The piece you just played, of course, was one of the greatest bones of contention. Is that rejoicing finale in the Fifth Symphony, which was the means through which Shostakovich rehabilitated himself with the Soviet official musical culture. A sincere expression of his devotion to the cause, or was it in some sense ironic? The impression it makes has a great deal to do with the tempo at which you play it. And Mravinsky's performance that you just played, a late performance of Mravinsky, is a good deal slower than the ones that he recorded earlier in his career, and therefore I would say probably than the one that he adopted in 1937. When you play that ending fast, it sounds heroic. It sounds like real rejoicing. When you slow it down, he doesn't play it nearly as slowly as, for example, Rostropovich did, especially during the years when Rostropovich was an emigre and, of course, very hostile to the Soviet Union. When you play it slowly, it sounds like, you know, an Excedrin commercial. It sounds like somebody's beating you on the head with, you know, drumsticks. It's rather painful.
But that's also an interpretation of the artist.
Yes,
and in the
indeed.
Case of both of these guys,
and
they grew up in the same system.
To compound the difficulty, different editions of the symphony differ as to the prescribed tempo of the final section by a factor of two. In other words, the final setting, I believe, is metronome 152. In some editions, that's the quarter note. In some editions, it's the half note. When it's the half note, it's going twice as fast as when it's the quarter note.
And you also can't play it that fast.
And you also can't play it that fast, but you can try. And when it's played really fast, Leonard Bernstein used to play it very, very fast. And, of course, the people who follow in the wake of Solomon Vocalov in testimony will say he's playing it much too fast. You miss the point, except, you know, he played it in that way in Shostakovich's presence in 1959 when the New York Philharmonic made a tour of the Soviet Union. And there are actual film clips of Shostakovich beaming and evidently delighted with the performance.
So he didn't pull a Stalin and get up and storm out.
He did not.
Well, I think that it should be a really informative and often entertaining time for anybody who wants to dip their toes into any portion of this this symposium. For more information and the complete schedule, you can go to slavic.illinois.edu, and then right on the homepage is a link to this symposium called Shostakovich, the Quartets in Context. And if you want to go hear Simon Morrison particularly, you have about 45 minutes to get over to the Levis Faculty Center and hear his address called Ghosts. And then there'll be a panel afterwards of made up of various folks from around the country. And then check out the rest of the schedule there as well. Well, we decided that we're going to go out with something quite lighthearted, which was representative of an awful lot of Shostakovich's music. This comes from what is variously called a suite for promenade orchestra, or not really well named, the Jazz Suite Number 2. And just very briefly, Simon, you know this, or have you know that he used Stanley Kubrick used this in a recent film.
Yeah, he used it in his last film, which is 1999, Eyes Wide Shut, and it's used right at the beginning, which shows Nicole Kidman exposed, getting ready to go out for a Christmas party with Nicole, with Tom Cruise, her doctor husband. And the film is off in many ways. It's a kind of estranged version of New York yuppiedom, and it's based on an expressionist tale. And what I love about the musical choices within the film is they're all a little bit off. And Kubrick was very... he knew musical literature very well, and he knew the context of these works, and he decided that he was going to actually show this pre dance pre-ball scene using a waltz, and he chose the most untypical waltz, which was not one by Richard Strauss, and not one by Tchaikovsky, but was one by Dmitri Shostakovich, which is gorgeous. And what I love about it is it's completely free of the context in which Shostakovich lived. It's just a great piece of music.
And you come by your film credentials very well, because I understand you teach that at Princeton as well.
Yeah, I teach it. I teach a lot of film music, but I don't think I'll ever write about it. It's pedagogical caprice.
It's Live and Local on FM 90.9. We've been with Richard Truskin and Simon Morrison this hour talking about Shostakovich. This is Illinois Public Media, WYLL FM and HD1 and HD2 Urbana, with translators W266 AF Urbana and W293 AF Danville. WYLL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois, and we have support from the Corkscrew's Bouvon Wine Bar, 203 North Vine, Urbana, with a full list of wines from around the world by the glass and by the bottle. Wine tastings are held every Saturday from noon to 4. Information at 217-337-7704 or on Facebook at Bouvon Wine Bar. Music from Shostakovich's Suite for Promenade Orchestra, a waltz with the Royal Concertgebouw Orchestra led by Ricardo Chailly on Live and Local.